Today on Wings.
We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. And what agriculture does is it destroys the soil. Every time you clear that land, which you have to do to plant those annual monocrops, you're destroying the soil. If we were able to restore 75% of the world's trashed grasslands, those plants could sequester essentially all the carbon that's produced since the beginning of the industrial age. The bison have to come home.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Liare Keith is a writer, radical feminist, food activist, and environmentalist. Her writing and lectures focus on civilization's violence against the planet, male violence against women, and the need for serious resistance to both. She is also involved in the Deep Green Resistance Movement and has co-written and edited books on this theme. But her own recent book is titled The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. Liare Keith was interviewed in 2012 by Megan Murphy, producer of the podcast series Feminist Current.
First, I want to talk to you about one of the topics that you write about that's controversial. A lot of people believe that veganism is the most ethical and the most healthy lifestyle for the planet. And in fact, you yourself were vegan for 20 years, is that right?
Just about, yep.
So I wonder if you can tell me what brought you back to animal products and why you argue that the vegan diet is not good either for individuals or for the health of the planet.
Right. Well, I always like to start this conversation by saying that the values that underlie the vegan ethic or the vegetarian ethic are not the problem. Values like compassion and sustainability and, you know, anything that questions human entitlement or human hubris, those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need, and that's still the moral core of my life, and it always has been. So that's not the problem. I think we have the values correct. The problem is, you know, the actions that flow from those values, and I would say that for most people who live in agricultural societies and certainly industrial societies, the problem is ignorance, and it's a very profound cultural ignorance about the nature of nature as opposed to the nature of agriculture. And questioning agriculture is something that almost nobody is willing to do because we live in an agricultural society, and we have now for 10,000 years. And that makes it really hard to question this really basic activity that underlies the entire society. So to put it in really blunt terms, agriculture is, you know, this is the activity. You take a piece of land, and you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's biotic cleansing. And so all those species have nowhere to go. And that's a long-winded way of saying mass extinction. And that's what agriculture is. That's not like agriculture on a bad day. That's what it actually is. That's what the activity consists of. So right now, at this point, agriculture has blown through every continent that it could. It's taken all the land that it possibly could. There's no land left. And what that's meant is that 99% of the prairies are gone from the planet. They've simply been eradicated. And 98% of the old-growth forests are gone. And that's what agriculture does. It devours. And it devours on a continental scale. So it's really hard to make the argument that something that has wiped out 98% of the animal's habitat can possibly be an activity that's good for animals. And the other problem, of course, is that it's drawdown. And what that means is, you know, it can't be sustainable. There's no way to sustain this activity because every single time you do it, you're drawing down all kinds of different resources, starting with living communities, biotic communities, moving on to species, water, of course, is drawdown of fossil water, and ultimately the soil itself. And this, in the end, is the complete insanity of this activity. Soil is the basis of life, or land life, anyway. I mean, we owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. And what agriculture does is it destroys the soil. Every time you clear that land, which you have to do to plant those annual monocrops, you're destroying the soil. So you're removing the plants that should be there, the plants whose job is actually to protect and increase soil, and that would be either trees or grasses, and you're replacing them instead with these domesticated annual plants, which don't, they can't do the same function. They're not meant to in nature. and they don't. And so, you know, just to put a number on that, 1 year of planting those crops, you can destroy 2,000 years of topsoil. And that's why there's no topsoil left now on the planet. We've essentially skinned the planet alive. Now, by the year 1950, the whole thing should have collapsed, because at that point, you know, the last chunk of soil was the Great Plains in North America. And that, it, by 1950, it was gone. Okay, it pretty much had blown through that as well. And, you know, the civilizations usually last between 800 and 1,500 years, which is the length that the topsoil holds out doing this activity called agriculture. So that's the pattern, is that, you know, the civilization, there's a power center that grows, and it takes from the surrounding area, and then eventually the whole thing collapses as the soil gives out. And that's happened over and over and over across the world as agriculture has spread. Well, by 1950, that should have been the end of it, because there weren't any more continents. And what happened instead was what's called the Green Revolution. So the scientists figured out how to make nitrogen out of oil and gas, and that's what we've been eating instead for the last, you know, 60 years. This is not a plan with the future. You know, you can't just flip from one non-renewable resource to another. You know, you can extend it a few decades by doing that, but, you know, in the end, the whole thing is going to collapse. And right now, if you're eating grain, what you're eating is oil on a stalk. So I understand that people think this is the correct way to behave, because factory farming is so horrendous, and we can all agree to that. But telling people to eat this plant-based diet that comes from this incredibly destructive activity is not going to save the planet.
So how do you respond to arguments like eating animals reinforces some kind of hierarchy, like speciesism?
There's no way out of this cycle. You can't remove animals from the picture and have a living planet. So the way that a grassland functions, for instance, is that first you've got the soil, and that's the matrix for everything. That's where that basic biological activity that makes life possible, that's where that's happening. And the people who protect the soil are the plants. Perennial plants have incredible root systems, especially prairie plants. And they're the ones who can drop water from far below. And one of their main activities, of course, is to break up rock and bring up minerals. And without that activity of drawing up the minerals, none of us would be here. And then they also absorb rainfall. So when the rain comes, they're able to store it in the soil. And their roots make that all possible. And then without the animals to actually graze through those prairie landscapes, it would actually turn into a desert. You absolutely have to have ruminants on those in those biotic communities, or else the whole thing is dead eventually. And there's a few reasons for that. One is that some plants will outcompete each other without the grazing activity to sort of level the playing field. And the other reason is that grasslands tend to be much drier than forests. That's why they're grasses and not trees. So the biological activity stops once there's not enough water. And it moves instead to the interior of animals' bodies. So it's the ruminants that are actually breaking down the cellulotic material and making the nutrients available again to the rest of the biotic community. So without ruminants, life just comes to a halt in those communities. And then you have another layer on top of that, which is predators. And they keep the ruminants in check. Without them, the ruminants, of course, will overshoot the land's carrying capacity. So everybody plays a role, and in the end, the soil eats us all. There is no way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I for many years, you know, I looked at my plate and I thought, well, if there's not a dead animal on it, then there's no death on it. And that's way too simplistic of a view, because your choice isn't, is there death on my plate? But really the only question is, what died to get this food onto my plate? Because no matter what you're looking at, something died.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at a plate full of food where everything on it participated in soil-building activities rather than destroying soil, then you can say this is a plate full. Yes, there's death involved, because there's always death involved in eating, but this was a plate of food that actually helped repair the planet. And that's really the only option we've got. We've got the death that's destroying everything, which is agriculture, and then we've got the death that's participating in those cycles and making them stronger. And I just want to point out that for our first 4 million years on this planet, we were participants. I mean, we were part of those soil-building communities. We had a role to play, and we played it. We ate, and in turn, we were eaten. And that's what nature does. It's just a constant recycling. It's not a hierarchy. We are all participants in our own way, and it's just a matter of time until, you know, every last molecule of my body is eaten, ultimately by plants and bacteria, and back around, you know, and I will be part of the hawk and part of the bear and part of the salmon and part of the redwoods and part of whoever's here. And it's not mine, it's just on loan, you know. I mean, we're all part of this tribe called carbon, you know, we get our moment and then we're done. And I had a hard time accepting that when I was a vegan. I really, really wanted my life to be possible without death. And I didn't understand that, you know, life and death are the same moment. So I understand that, you know, it, because in Western culture, especially, you know, coming out of Christianity, there is a hierarchy in the Bible, absolutely. And it's, you know, people, then animals, and then plants, and then that's it. You know, there's not even anybody else that exists. And of course, you know, as an aside, that's one of the reasons that people like Louis Pasteur had a terrible time, you know, getting Europe to understand that, that microbes existed. It's because they weren't in the Bible. So there was this whole level of life that they couldn't accept as real because it wasn't mentioned. So how could it be true that there were microbes in the world? Of course, they had microscopes by then, and they could see the activities of these creatures and started to understand how basic they were to, you know, life functions like creating oxygen. But it took a few generations for people to really accept it because the Bible didn't mention them. That hierarchy goes back to the ancient Greeks as well. You know, people as the most animate, and animals as sort of animate, and then plants as just dead matter for everybody to eat. And that is a very patriarchal, hierarchical system. And I would contrast that to pretty much every indigenous life way that anybody's ever come up with, which is that we are all related to each other and we are all simply taking turns. And that's a very different way to look at it. Every single being on this planet is alive, and, you know, we have the same substance inside us somehow, which means that we can communicate. So these are all beings with whom which we can enter into a relationship, and that relationship needs to be one of respect, of mutual respect. And if we can return to those kinds of relationships, you know, there's still hope that we could repair this planet. But as long as we're still in the hierarchical mode, I don't think there's any hope. But agriculture is the basic activity that embodies that hierarchy most of all, because it simply wipes everything out and puts humans there instead.
You're listening to an interview with writer, radical feminist, food activist, and environmentalist Lier Keith, author of the book The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. She was interviewed in August 2012 by Megan Murphy, producer of the podcast series Feminist Current.
So the problem with eating animal products in our culture, at least one of the biggest problems, is factory farming, which is horrific and destructive and awful. And of course, it makes sense that we would want to avoid that at all costs. But, you know, how can we eat healthfully and ethically and survive on this planet at the same time? What would that look like?
Well, there's a couple ways to approach that. And one is just personally, you know, I, as someone who's trying to be ethical, what should I do? And then there's the second level of that, which is, as a culture, what are we going to do? So for the first level, the best thing you can do is ask yourself, does this food build topsoil or does it destroy topsoil? Because if you're building topsoil, chances are you're providing habitat for animals that need it. Chances are you're restoring the water table. Chances are you are repairing the riparian, you know, the waterways that are under such assault from agriculture. And chances are very good that there's no fossil fuel involved, because grasslands, prairie systems are self-sustaining. You don't need to add any inputs because it's exactly what nature has done for, you know, a few million years now. And so that would include mostly ruminants on grass. It would include other animals as well, because to have a system that's actually resilient and that sort of includes every function that you need for it to be a closed loop, there's other animals as well that are probably going to be part of it. I mean, there's no standalone system that's just a ruminant and grass. I mean, there are always birds. There are always other small mammals. You know, there's going to be amphibians. There's, you know, all kinds of creatures that need to be there as well. But if you have the perennial polyculture, if you have the grass and you have the ruminants, the other creatures will come home. And this is what, you know, you see over and over again when you go to farms that have made the transition to grass-based farming. There's just this incredible, this lushness of life that returns, and often within the first year. And I have talked to so many farmers now who have done this on their land. And, I mean, they've got tears in their eyes because they've seen birds that they haven't seen since, you know, they were young children. So it's been 50 or 60 years since they've seen, you know, these birds, and now they're back. And it's because they've got habitat again. So try to find the farms in your area. You will not be able to buy this food at the store, or it's unlikely, unless you've got a really great local grocery store. You'll have to find the farmers, and you'll have to go get the food. And the best website about this is eatwild.com, which is run by a wonderful woman named Jo Robinson. and she also wrote a book called Pasture Perfect, and she will walk you through everything, why this is so important, what it means, how helpful it is, what it will do for your health, what it will do for the planet. And then on her website, you can click on whatever state or province you're in and find all the farms that are doing it right. And that's the best way to get the food. And it's the best thing for the farmer, because the more they can cut out the middleman, the more profit they will get, the more likely it is that they can actually afford to keep farming. I think it's really important, too, for people to have a personal relationship with the farm, with the animals, with the land, with the grass, with all the creatures that are living there, and making that resilient biotic community again. It's really important to see it. And it's important to see where your food comes from, and to develop those personal relationships, I think, is a really key thing, just emotionally as well as politically. So that's the basic question. Is my food producing topsoil, or is it destroying topsoil? So that really is going to mean some kind of large animal on grass at this point. And then, you know, the other animals that are also part of it. So you can get eggs that are from pasture-raised hens. Usually that's part of the whole farm system. Or, you know, it could be ducks, it could be turkeys. There's, you know, all kinds of poultry that can be introduced into it as well. But they play a really important role, because they'll eat the bugs and they keep the larger animals from the diseases and the pests that can really, you know, infect them. It keeps it much cleaner for everybody, because everybody is eating at a slightly different level. So you do need somebody to break up the manure and to eat the bugs in the manure, and that's what poultry do. That's why birds follow ruminants. You're not going to find a ruminant in nature that does not have birds following behind. And they have these incredible relationships sometimes, where the birds actually ride on the backs of the different mammals and will groom them, you know, eat the bugs off their coats and stuff. Even you can see pictures of the animals staying there with their eyes shut, you know, bison or, you know, wildebeest or whoever, and they've got their eyes shut, and the birds are, like, literally picking little bugs mm-hmm. out from around their eyes. So these, you know, these are clearly relationships that are very tender and, mm-hmm. and very trustful. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I let anybody near my eyes, especially with a beak. Mm. You do this. I think for this continent, you know, and this is back to the big political level, the only hope we've really got is the bison. It's the bison that have to come home. And that means, you know, huge swaths of the Great American Prairie have got to be restored. If we were able to restore 75% of the world's trashed grasslands, and let's be clear, they've been trashed for agriculture. If we were able to restore those to grass, it would only take about 15 years, and those plants could sequester enough carbon that it would be essentially all the carbon that's produced since the beginning of the industrial age. And that's an incredible statistic. But in 15 mm-hmm. years, we could stop global warming dead in its tracks. And all we have to do is let the plants and the animals come home. We just have to stop fighting this war against the planet, declare a truce, and let the planet repair itself. And it's not too late, I guess is what I'm saying. But we need a totally different economic system to go with that. And as part of that, of course, a totally different food system. And that's where it gets political. Changes have to be made on a public policy level, and then that has to trickle down into the culture so that we all understand how important it is to buy this food rather than the food that's, you know, based on those destructive activities. But mm-hmm. this is food that could repair the planet, not just our health, but really, I think it's the only hope we've got at this point.
Obviously, making personal change is important and valuable. But there's also this idea tied to this individualism that's so popular within the West that says that we can change the world by demonstrating good or ethical behavior ourselves, and then this behavior will spread and will affect change. So what do you think about that idea?
Well, I like to say that the task of an activist is not to navigate around systems of oppression with as much personal integrity as possible. It's actually to destroy those systems, it's to dismantle those systems. So, you know, we can live these super, uber pure lives, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it has nano effect. There are no personal solutions to political problems. And the only thing that's going to change systems of oppression is people making common cause and actually doing direct confrontations with power, and either taking over institutions or dismantling the institutions and then rearranging toward justice so that we actually control the material conditions of our lives. So dismantling those hierarchies. And there's no way to do that as an individual. It simply can't be done. And this really cuts to one of the main differences between liberals and radicals, because liberals think that society is made up of individuals. That's really core to a liberal ideology. I mean, to the point where saying that somebody is a member of a group is actually seen as an insult. You know, saying somebody's a woman or saying somebody's a person of color, you know, pointing that out is, you know, somehow an insult that, you know, we're all supposed to be, you know, the same, equal, whatever, and then there are no distinctions. And that just completely overlooks the fact that there is brutal, corrupt, horrendous, violent power arrangements on this planet, and that, you know, it's only by making common cause with others and understanding that we share a class condition. That's a liberating moment, just psychologically, but when you actually make that common cause and build those movements, that's the only thing that changes those power arrangements. So there's no insult in, you know, claiming that, you know, you're part of an oppressed group, and in fact, it's really the first step toward liberation. And that's one of the main differences between liberals and radicals. So for liberals, of course, it's only individuals that can change, because that's the basic unit of society, whereas for radicals, you know, you have to join forces with people who are in the same position that you are, and allies too, of course, and then you can fight as a group. Then you've got some kind of political power that you can try to dismantle the oppressive system. So for whatever reason, the left in this country has really just, it's been saturated with this kind of liberal ideology and forgotten what it used to know in terms of being radical. I don't know how bad it is in Canada, but I think in the United States we really have not had an honest-to-God left since about the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
We've certainly had leftist people who've tried very hard, but it's really just evolved into this kind of individualism, which of course segues very neatly into the demands of this sort of globalized corporate neoliberalism, because they want us to see ourselves as individuals who only have private lives, which are defined by consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is exactly what they want.
And I want to, of course, touch on patriarchy, the relationship between patriarchy and civilization and agriculture and the destruction of the planet. Can you talk a little bit about how that's tied together?
Sure. I would say that, you know, patriarchy is a system that takes human beings that are born either biologically male or female, and then it turns them into social classes of people called men and women. Any system of oppression tries to make a claim that this is natural or that it was, you know, created by God. And either way, you can't fight it. And patriarchy is no different. So it creates these two classes using some pretty brutal socialization practices and then tries to tell us, well, this is natural. Well, if it's so natural, you know, why do these terrible things have to be done to children to get them to conform to this? So for little boys, of course, you know, they're socialized to become men. And the psychology that they're socialized to is really the psychology that's necessary for soldiers. So they have to be emotionally numb, and they have to have an incredible amount of entitlement, especially to people called women. And then the final thing is there's a psychology that is called a negative reference group, and it means that you can turn people who are not you into others. So they're not human. You know, mm-hmm. You can look around the world and say, this group of people is not like me. They embody certain things that I will never be, and those other things make them subhuman. So they're objects to be used, they're people to be exploited, but they're not human. And, of course, in patriarchy, the first template for this is how boys treat girls. And, you know, the number of times that I've met otherwise, you know, reasonable, progressive people who will say things like, oh, well, my son is just going through his I hate girls phase. And I always just draw them up short and said, okay, if your little boy came home and he said that about, you know, the Jewish kids in the class, you tell me that would be okay to you? You know, you would be able to say, oh, he's just going through, you know, his I hate indigenous people phase? And, of
mm-hmm.
course, they're horrified at this thought. And but it's okay to say, well, it's his I hate girls phase. And then they try to pull this thing, well, you know, they grow out of it. I'm like, where's the evidence? Battering is the most commonly committed crime in the United States. Is that
mm-hmm.
violent crime? That's a man beating up a woman. Where is the evidence that they grow out of this? They don't grow out of this. This is set up for life. They
mm-hmm.
hate girls, and they grow on to hate women. So that's, you know, the basic template, is they're able to turn a whole group of people into other. And then when you live in a militaristic imperialist society that needs soldiers, it's really simple. You can fill in that category with any other group of people that the dominant society needs oppressed. So it's really simple. You can just call them whatever hate speech you want, and now they're subhuman and can be, you know, killed with impunity. So this is why patriarchy and militarism tend to go together. It's because it's the same psychology that's necessary for soldiers. Okay, so that's what it takes to turn boys into men. And I will say it's a fairly brutal process. I watched what happened to my brother when I was growing up. He went from being a pretty sweet little kid to, you know, being a pretty horrifying adult. And, you know, I don't really understand why more men are not pro-feminist, because I don't think it's any fun being a man. They certainly get all the power and the privilege. I mean, I get that part of it, certainly, but I don't really understand, you know, emotionally, it's no fun having
mm-hmm.
them and be, you know, dominating. And the other thing it creates is this violation imperative. So men prove, they become real men. You know, you're never really a man. You can never be a real man in patriarchy. It's something that always has to be proved. And ultimately, it's because they're suppressing, you know, the parts of human beings that make life worthwhile. So it's, you know, their connection to others, that the care and the compassion that we're all capable of. You can never do that enough, right? It's a constant battle you have to wage. So it's a battle that's never won. So they're constantly having to prove that they're men. And the way that they do that, of course, is by violating. So this is the violation imperative that's really intrinsic to masculinity. So men become real men by hurting and by violating. Now, that violation imperative, it sort of joined forces with these other social systems like civilization, like capitalism, which are also based on violation and certainly on domination. So at this point, it feels like it's just one huge sociopathic feeding frenzy out there of destruction. So whether it's violating like the boundaries of women and girls, whether it's violating the boundaries of, you know, forests and prairies and rivers, whether it's violating the boundaries of the moon, whether it's violating the boundaries of the genetic code. So we've got like transgenic salmon now and all this, you know, genetically modified corn and soy and wheat. You know, they're breaking the boundaries of DNA. And ultimately the boundaries of the atom itself with, you know, the atom bomb. All of this is based on that violation imperative that they have to keep violating. But there's nothing that's sacrosanct. There's no way to say no. The moment that anybody says no, that's a boundary they're going to have to break to keep proving that they're men. And so this is why I think you can't be an environmentalist without being a feminist, and you can't be a peace activist without being a feminist, and you can't be a peace activist without being an environmentalist. And I don't actually care which direction you come at this from or what your work is in the world, because God knows there's plenty of good work to do. Mm-hmm. But all of it, yeah, I think this is what radical feminists bring to the table. You've got to understand that masculinity is core to this, so that the violation imperative that half the population has been socialized to, that is what underlies all of it. So they don't just, this is the brilliance of patriarchy, they don't just naturalize oppression. They don't just say, well, this is the way nature made us, or this is, you know, God's work. They take those acts of oppression and they turn them into, they eroticize them. So domination and subordination are eroticized into sexual acts. So they're experienced as sex by most people in this culture. Mm-hmm. And they're institutionalized then into masculinity and femininity. So then it just seems like, you know, this is how people are supposed to behave because it's institutionalized. So first it naturalizes it, then it eroticizes it, and then it institutionalizes it. And that, to me, is a really brilliant system. And I think that's one of the reasons that patriarchy is really hard to dislodge. And the only thing we've got on our side is that, you know, as feminists, we figured that out. So at least we're onto their game.
That was Liere Keith, interviewed about her book, The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. You can find more about Keith and the Deep Green Resistance Movement she co-founded at her website, www.lierekeith.com. Liere is spelled L-I-E-R-R-E. The interviewer was Megan Murphy, who produces the Feminist Current podcast series. You can find her podcasts as well as her feminist essays at www.feministcurrent.com. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/wingsradio, where you'll find daily updates of news about women from mainstream and alternative sources. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm the series producer, Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.